We'd like to welcome
Love
you.
Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome you again to another episode of Africa on the Move. Tonight we got a very special guest, and I say very special guest because I believe based upon his experiences and his world travel, he can offer a very unique perspective, particularly a very unique Pan-African perspective on the theme tonight, which we would like to discuss, the state of Africa and the Africa diaspora. With us, we have Brother Dedan Kamafi. He's a political organizer, a Pan-Africanist, and a world traveler. He will come and share his views on this particular theme tonight. Brother Dedan, welcome to Africa on the Move.
Greetings and ready for the revolution, as Kwame Ture used to say.
Brother Dedan, before we get started, I gave a brief introduction about your background. Would you like to share any additional things that you'd like to share with our audience? Because you have done so many things, and I don't want to shortchange accomplishments that you have made.
I'm a father of two girls. I'm proud of that. And everything else is, you know, as we discuss it, things will come out. There's no problem.
Okay. First thing we would just like to give you, actually just a general statement. If someone asked you in 2012 today, taking a look at Africa, the state of Africa, what would be your analysis of the present state of Africa in general?
Well, I believe that Africa today is in transition from the prior era where United States imperialism was the monolithic sole economic world power, with the demise of the Soviet Union under Gorbachev in the early 1990s. So from early 1990s until about 95, 98, it was unchallenged economically, and of course, militarily and politically, especially with the United Nations Security Council being dominated pretty much by historically Western forces. But with the rise of the Latin American bloc, of SECOR and ALBA, together with the Asian giants of China, India, and numerous other Asian countries like Indonesia and Malaysia, that they have challenged the United States' economic hegemony and, in fact, are secondary to these new emerging third world economic powers. And that African countries, historically, under neocolonialism, except for the liberated zones of Zimbabwe, Sudan, Libya, Eritrea, were forced into economic agreements with the United States. But internal to African countries has been its demand, and we saw it first with the Cote d'Ivoire, Laurent Gbagbo, and the Sudan, among others. They have now fought for the right to sell their natural resources, their mineral resources, as well as open up their markets to the best bidders in the world, to the best deals. And more we're seeing African countries cutting deals for their natural resources, as well as receiving finished goods from China, India, and especially Portuguese-speaking Africa, is Brazil. And it's growing. I know Hugo Chavez in Venezuela is reaching out for economic agreement, oil, for natural resources. And so because African countries have chosen to take an independent economic path that serves their best interests, the United States is losing. The United States and Western Europe is losing their historical monopoly of natural resources, as well as the markets of Africa. And Africa has one of the fastest growing middle classes in the world. In the top 10 fastest growing economies, 8 are in Africa. So what we now see is that this transition as a beacon of hope to break the neocolonial ties is being challenged by the United States and NATO with military aggression to destabilize those governments, those political parties that have chosen to sell their natural resources and open up their markets to the best deal in terms of almost like a laissez-faire economic approach. And since the United States and NATO, Western European countries, cannot compete at an economic level, what they're doing is invading African countries and setting in motion proxy governments to destabilize African economies and governments that choose to develop new economic ties with the rising third world economic giant, economic lion And that's why we find, like in Libya today, United States through NATO destabilizing the revolutionary government of the Zamaria. That's why we found the French invading North Cote d'Ivoire. That's why we found this whole buffoonery about Darfur and Arab versus Africa, a bunch of lies, and slavery, a bunch of lies. But then we saw last week that the United States' surrogate or sister country, some say mother country, Israel, bombing the Sudan. We've seen the rise of propaganda assault against Eritrea, which has no relationship to the IMF and World Bank. So right now, Africa's up for grabs. The United States and NATO, in particular, all former colonial powers and or neocolonial powers, are trying to use military aggression, which really shows the bankruptcy of the Western powers, because they cannot economically convince African countries to trade with them because they get a better deal. I mean, for instance, with China, which is a giant right now, they don't care. Chinese don't have military troops in Africa. China doesn't have a CIA in Africa. China doesn't impose their movies, their television shows, their values of homosexuality or whatever on Africa. China doesn't impose their culture on Africa. All China says is, we want your natural resources, regardless of your government, whether you're a socialist government, a neocolonial government, dictator, we don't care. We just want your natural resources, and we'll pay market value, which historically has not occurred in Africa because of neocolonial, former colonial agreements, which I've actually read, for the Cote d'Ivoire and Sudan, that the natural resources of Africa are being sold to the West many times at 20 and 30% below market value because of those old historical economic agreements that were signed into effect as part of the decolonization independence agreements. So now we're finding that China, for instance, is much more attractive, not only because of the economic agreement, but China has no history, for instance. India has no history of colonialism, has no history of destabilizing and overthrowing popular democratic governments like in the Congo, okay, or like in Ghana, okay? As well as being a third world country, they themselves have been victimized, and they're willing to get involved in what they call technology transfer, where they will provide not just the natural resources, but build critically needed infrastructure, and not just build the infrastructure, but train African engineers in how to sustain and duplicate and expand those infrastructures so that we can begin having an economy that's internal to Africa rather than a historical economic reality from slavery to colonialism, neocolonialism, where everything's external to Africa. That's kind of a brief overview. We can go in more detail.
Okay, that is fine. Let me raise something in terms of your presentation just now. We often hear talks about the role of China in Africa today. It's one as the new exploiter. They said China's exploring Africa just like the Europeans have done historically. According to your presentation, I assume you would disagree with that notion.
Right. I mean, historically, China has never been a colonialist. China was never involved with slavery. China has never imposed Eurocentric culture or Buddhist or Tao or Maoist ideology, imposed it in Africa. China is not coup d'etat. China has always supported, not 100%, but probably about 90%, all the anti-colonial movements in Africa. In fact, if we look at Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe African National Union, headed by Mugabe, which is taking a principal stand of taking the land that was stolen by the European settler colonies and putting it back in the hands of Africa, their major political and military support during the anti-colonial movement was China. So I might go on the list, but I think we need to be careful when we say that China is going to do with the United States. Of course, China is not Africa, and Africa should only have permanent interests of Africa. No permanent friends, just permanent interests. But in terms of the world market today, the natural resources of Africa need to be put out there for the world to benefit from, as well as to generate needed capital, as well as technology development, infrastructure development, so Africa at some point won't be selling its natural resources to Asia or to Latin America or to Europe, but will be using those natural resources and produce finished goods, final products, can take oil, for instance, and produce 26 different byproducts of oil, whether it's kerosene or all the variables that come from that. But if we look at mighty Nigeria today, Nigeria doesn't have one refinery in Nigeria. It's really pathetic because Nigeria, on the so-called, what they call black market, along the, for instance, the Niger Delta area, along the rich oil fields, you've got brothers like you and me from the streets who are basically cracking into the oil pipes to Port Harcourt. They're being shipped to the West, stealing, quote-unquote, or taking back the oil, the local natives, the local upper proletariat, and they have produced their own little guerrilla, ghetto, street refineries, and they're selling finished gasoline. The mighty government, the mighty Nigerian oil corporations controlled by the British and the United States can't refine and produce gasoline for Nigerians, but the brothers on the street do some guerrilla, lumping, gangster activities are doing it on the guerrilla tip. So the critical question for Africa is that African leadership, the African government must be very serious about taking this natural resources and, number one, producing finished products, refining it and selling it to the world, as well as being very diplomatic in how they, who they sell to, why they sell to, and get the best deal on the market. And once again, China has no history of slavery or colonialism, neocolonialism, or its own democratic governments. It has no history at all. But then again, China's interest is China. But they do have a very progressive, non-aligned foreign policy. And historically, China's been in the vanguard of the non-aligned movement, the Afro-Asian solidarity movement. Even our brother Malcolm X talked about the great conference at Bangoon, but only third world countries, countries of color, can attend. All the European countries were banned from attending. Because Malcolm X, Elhaj Manik al-Shabaab, saw the importance of people of color uniting against European capitalism, European white supremacy.
Okay, we'd like to let our callers know that tonight we are discussing with Brother Dilon Kamafi on the state of Africa and the African diaspora. And we'd like to invite them, if they have any views or comments on this particular theme tonight, they can call 323-679-0841. That's 323-679-0841. I believe we have a caller. Let's take this caller. Caller, welcome to African Speak, number 3860. Yes, caller, go ahead. 3860, the last four numbers.
Hey, yeah, I'm just calling in and listening in for the moment.
Okay, do you have any comments right now you want to make?
No, not right now.
Okay, we just put you on hold. All right, Brother Dilon, in terms of looking at the role of the OAU, at this stage of that development, is it a hindrance or is it an asset as relates to Africa moving forward and becoming unified and liberated from the West? What is really the role of the OAU today as relates to this phenomenon?
I think that, first of all, at the founding of the OAU, the Organization of African Unity, like Brother Nkrumah, like Brother Kwame Ture said, it's the most minimum aspect of unity that can occur. It's not what we need, what we want, but it's a step in the right direction. And I think in the last 10 years, under the chairmanship of Muammar Gaddafi, where they renamed it from the Organization of African Unity to the African Union, it was moving forward towards more intense centralization, as well as developing their own satellite system, which exists, as well as developing their own standard, the gold dinar. I think that's one of the major reasons, and I don't think it was oil. I think the major reason why the United States orchestrated the overthrow of the Jamhuria under the leadership of Muammar Gaddafi was not the oil of Libya, but the work that was being done with the finance coming out of Libya to build a stronger African Union. I think the African Union right now is politically bankrupt because of its failure to intercede in the Sudan, with Israel and Sudan, with its failure to intercede in Libya, United States and NATO, with its failure to intercede when the French invaded North Cote d'Ivoire. But some level of unity is better than no unity at all. If there was no African Union, that would be our first step to build an African Union. We have that in place today. And if you look at their website, they have a number of 10 African departments, fisheries, lumber, teaching, education, agriculture, and so forth. So at that level of infrastructure, you know, it's moving forward at that level. But in terms of the objective of African unity, one United States of Africa, as well as defending Africa from foreign intervention, AU has failed.
Okay. In terms of this question of, let's take a look at Libya, in terms of what recently just happened to Libya this past year or so, what lessons can we learn from that? I know you had a chance to go there several times. What did you discover when you went there? And give us your version of what really has taken place and is taking place present in Libya on the ground as it relates to the people.
Well, I think just from a Pan-African perspective, what we lack is a Pan-African movement for the defense of Africa. We lack that. And that's just not Africa, but all of us in the diaspora. We don't have a Pan-African movement for the defense of Africa. We need to build that. And actually, I'm having a discussion with people about putting that into being so that whenever Western or outside forces invade Africa, you can have a global response. Like, for instance, last week when Israel bombed the Sudan's military plants, and it's not the first time the United States bombed the pharmaceutical sector, which actually walked the ground to the bombing. And there was not even just peacefully, a mass demonstration at Israeli embassies all over the world. That's the minimum. That's the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first criticism has to be raised that we don't, we've been blessed to have the Convention People's Party, the Democratic Party of Guinea, the All African People's Revolutionary Party. But the problem is, parties come into being from mass movements. So the Convention People's Party came into being from the mass movement of Ghanaians wanting national independence. Same with the PDG in Guinea, same with the AEPRP. But we never had a mass Pan-African movement. And when you have a mass Pan-African movement, then these parties can then recruit from these movements that build strong country worldwide and become the fighting force against Western imperialism. And I think in the case of Libya, though we had some demonstrations in Europe, in the United States, and Africa, it wasn't a mass protest. Like, for instance, we saw in the anti-Vietnam War campaign that we had organized, those of us who were involved in the anti-war campaign back in the 60s and 70s, or even the anti-war campaign against Iraq, which the White Left organized successfully. You know what I'm saying? Like, we got to criticize ourselves. A wonderful analysis. I think the heroic people of Libya put up a damn good fight, because when the United States have released over 1,000 Al-Qaeda Libyan operatives that got arrested in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and cut a deal with Qaddafi to bring it back into Libya, they were in prison, and supposedly they made an agreement not to be involved with Western-inspired Al-Qaeda-type terrorist activities. You know, within a couple months of their being released, you saw what happened in Benghazi, where they're operating as a covert wing of the CIA, just like they're operating in Syria today, just like they're operating in Afghanistan and Iraak, destabilize the government and set in motion a process where it legitimizes that nation. First of all, no-fly zone, and then, of course, we found out later, there were actual Israeli and U.S. troops together with the surrogates of Qatar and Saudi Arabia on the ground inside Libya. And the people put up a good fight, but without the use of air power, number one, and what they call, Malcolm X called dollarism, but he flooded in air cargo planes full of pallets of money to buy off a lot of the members of the Jamalia who were not principally committed to the revolution, but could be bought off. We saw the demise of the Jamalia. But then, once again, obviously the Jamalia still exists, what they call the Green Resistance, who are responsible for the assassination of the U.S. ambassador and his adjuncts in Benghazi, which, by the way, Benghazi was the basis, U.S. basis, for the overthrow of the government, the democratic government of Libya. I thought it was a really good, like Malcolm X talking about, the chickens gonna come home to roost. The same force that the United States used to overthrow the Jamalia turned around and started assassinating U.S. diplomatic emissaries inside Benghazi. And clearly in Libya today, there is no stability. You've got the Muslim Brotherhood, you've got the Salafis, you've got Al-Qaeda, all them fighting to bring Libya back to the pre-colonial feudal days. And those of us who've been to Libya recognize that Libya had the highest literacy rate, highest education rate, the most advanced role for women in the whole of North Africa. Libya went from being the poorest country in Africa and the Middle East back in 1959-60 to becoming the number one country in terms of quality of life in the whole of Africa. So the Green Revolution, the Jamarias, are still alive and struggling, and we just had a big tribute, our comrades in London for Brother Qaddafi. We're doing a tribute in L.A. next week for Brother Qaddafi, the Jamalia. So just like with Osagie Kwame Nkrumah, more Africans know about Nkrumah today or about Malcolm X today than they did when they were alive. So I think that the spirit of Colonel Brother Qaddafi and the Jamalia will live for many, many centuries onward. And the vision of Qaddafi, the vision of Nkrumah, the vision of Ture is a scientific vision. It's only logical for Africa to unite. We were artificially divided. We were artificially caused into all these different micro states, the Ghana and the Nigeria. It's only logical from economies of scale, from common sense, that, you know, 55 countries coming together can be much more effective working together than fighting among themselves, like we find in Somalia and Kenya and Ethiopia and the rest of and Uganda and the rest of Rwanda. I can go down the list and the rest of manipulating and divide and conquer on a strategy, you know?
That's my audience again. You listen to Africa on the Move. I'm Brother African, and if you'd like to join in the discussion, we're dealing with the state of Africa and the African diaspora. Feel free to call in at 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. We're talking a little bit about Libya. Can we get your analysis, your take on what is presently happening in Tanzania, South Africa, as it relates to the miners, the strikes, the massacre that has been taking place for the past month? What do you make of that, given the fact that many of these strikers and their leadership was once part of a liberation movement that were fighting for the liberation of their people? But some of these same leaders are now having a policy that seems to be going against the same people to help them to get out their suffering earlier under colonialism. What is your make of this whole phenomenon that's going on in South Africa right now?
Well, I think that the Western media had pumped up the African National Congress as being the true representative of the masses of African people, but in fact it was the Pan-African Congress, and the Zapo and Mbeki Jim, they actually represent the masses of African people. The African National Congress is the United Front, they also have trade union movements, the South African Communist Party. They have a wide range of non-African interests, you know, and of course, when Mandela gained freedom and the ANC came to power, they guaranteed European capitalists their privileged status in the new South Africa. Let me repeat that again. When African National Congress came to power, led by Nelson Mandela, they guaranteed the European settlers their property rights. Whatever they owned before under colonialism, they would continue to own after so-called liberation. And of course, what that meant was that the class stratification, that was primarily ethnic stratification, changed only in one form. And you got white folks who are poor and unemployed together with Africans. But the African masses, the quality of life never changed. In fact, it got worse because as capitalism advanced and new economic deals were coming to IMF and the World Bank, the different austerity programs, they cut back the social service programs, as well as because the objective, let's say the mining industry is to maximize profit, they want to reduce and keep repressed the wages, housing, benefits for the miners in South Africa. And at a certain point, when they see this affluence of the Europeans, together with a small 0.01% of African petit bourgeois, then it made the contradictions more intense. But for a while, they camouflaged it under the banner of we got our own flag, we got black leadership, therefore things are going to be better. But the materialism, dialectic materialism, teaches us that the material reality dominates, you know, whatever rhetoric they put out there. The quality of life of the miners, the quality of life of the teachers, the quality of life of all the different striking sectors got increasingly worse. So, of course, the African National Congress never provided the hope of change, to use Obama's term. In fact, we never got the material transformation, the quality of life of Africans in America under the Obama administration that never occurred under Nelson Mandela, the African National Congress administration. So, of course, people went on strike. Of course, people are going to get Julius Malembe is going to come out here and say, you know, one settler, one bullet, we need to nationalize all the mineral resources. We need to
international at the light manufacturing sector. He did let you in the valley. We have hold of the large agricultural plantations owned by Europeans. The African National Congress, they defined the contradiction as apartheid. All we need to do is vote. But the problem became this. Who are you voting for? You're the ANC. You've got this European, European political party. You have no option. So voting between one capitalist party versus another capitalist party definitely increases the quality of life. In fact, it reduces the quality of life in those of bourgeois elections. The fundamental question was socialism, nationalization of the land, scientific socialism, all sectors of the economy, but put in the hands of the working class, put in the hands of the business, put in the hands of the Africans. That never occurred. And it's not in the ANC's mandate. It's not in the ANC's freedom charter to do that. For them to do that will break up the ANC, because the ANC, once again, is a united front. It incorporates a wide range of interests, but primarily very powerful European financial interests are tied to the ANC. The ANC needs to have a revolution in the revolution and sell out the European capitalist sector that dominates the ANC today.
Okay, we got about 3 minutes left, and I definitely know that when we talk about the state of the Africans in the diaspora, there's one country I think we need to talk a little bit about. And I know that you recently just came from this country, and which we know very little about, but we hate the most. And that country is Cuba. Can you just give us a general synopsis of what did you find when you went to Cuba and Cuba's relationship to Africa as it relates to moving forward?
I don't think world citizens, whether in Europe or Africa or Asia, Latin America, even the United States, hate Cuba. I don't believe that. I think people love Cuba, and that's precisely why there were 500 some attempts to overthrow the Cuban government has failed. Because the masses of humanity, and you've been in Cuba, you see millions of Europeans going there. Latin Americans, and even the most reactionary Latin American governments, all support the right of Cuba to self-determination. Even in the United States, the separate Gusanos, the neocon Gusanos of Florida and New York, who hope to go back to the good old days of the mafia controlling Cuba. The masses of the U.S. citizens believe in their right to close down the economic blockade, believe in their right of Cuba to sit at the table of all nations and have freedom for trade and economic development. And so Cuba is kind of like we all been raised within this Christian notion of David and Goliath. And Cuba is the David. It has, in 1959, with 13 U.S. presidents, defeated mighty Goliath. And so we all like the underdog, especially Africans, always being the underdog, you know what I'm saying? We're always the underdog. We have a certain affinity towards the underdog. And Cuba is a shining example of the power of ideology, the power of internationalism, and the power of organization to defeat mighty United States imperialism, together with NATO and all the other forces, you know?
Okay, in closing, we have 1 minute left, Brother Dion. Given the fact that we're dealing with the state of Africa and the Africans in diaspora, for those individuals who would like to make a contribution to try to help move our people forward, what is your best advice you can give us or give them?
Join an organization fighting for African people. Join the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Join any organization fighting for our people. If you don't have the time to become a cadre or militant, a member of a political party, a revolutionary party, join support work versus the work you do with Cuba, the work we do with the Maui, the work we do with Cote d'Ivoire, the work we do with Eritrea. We need to, besides our normal, I just left a meeting about an hour ago, and the young new Black Panthers in L.A., the Black Riders, all the little Black youth sets, ex-gang members that became political by 8 different organizations, coming together. And they're coming together to fight police brutality and so forth and so on. But my message to them was also, let's invest some time in Mother Africa. Because after the final analysis, it's going to be our mothership of liberation.
Okay, I believe we have one quick caller, all over the caller would like to say something. Quickly call in 30 seconds. Okay, I guess the caller just listened in. We'd like to thank our audience. We'd like to thank you for their participation. We'd like to thank our guest, Brother Dion, for giving his analysis on the state of Africa and the African diaspora. Until next time, we'd like to encourage our audience, if you don't do anything else, is to read. Acquire your information. Because it's only through information where you can think. And it's only through organization where you can think clearly. We'd like to thank you all for watching and listening to After on the Move. And we see you next week, same time, same station. Let's go forward and backwards novel. Africa on the Move.